To the audience and to the Honorable A. Clayton Powell, I wish to present to you a resolution that was prepared by the House of Representatives of Michigan welcoming you to our state. Godspeed.
Thank you, old man. At least I don't have to follow the dog act. I wish they'd turn the lights off if it's all right with you, Mr. Stage Manager. I know they don't want to see me, but I want to see them. I spoke when I launched my fall tour, and I hate to use a dirty word here, at the University of Michigan. Just before I left New York to come to speak, I got a second contract from the University of Michigan, which is apropos of being here. And this is the second part, and you can see the staples where they staple it to my original contract. In other words, the State Board of Education of Michigan passed this when hearing that I was coming to the University of Michigan, and I would like to read to you what they said in this action, which is germane to me being here at Michigan State. It is the policy of the State Board of Education and the universities under this board to foster a spirit of free inquiry and to encourage the timely discussion of a wide variety of issues, provided that the views expressed are stated openly and are subject to critical evaluation. The speaker must not urge the audience to take any action which is prohibited by the rules of the university or which is illegal in the state of Michigan. Advocating or urging the modification of the government of the state of Michigan fantastic. Is specifically prohibited, and it is the responsibility of the student organization to inform speakers of these prohibitions. Any student organization violating the provisions of this bylaw is subject to the procedures and penalties applicable to students and student organizations that violate other university rules. Well, somebody's in trouble because nobody told me about that. So when I got to the University of Michigan, I read it to them, and I read to you what I said there. I said, well, those of you who finished with your card burning, you can go over to the library now and burn up the Declaration of Independence, because Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter it or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect the safety and happiness of all citizens. So if you want to have a nice burning party, you can go over to the library and burn the Declaration of Independence. I've been speaking across the country since a year ago, January. My first appearance on any campus was at UCLA, and I've talked to about 200,000 plus students all over this nation. I have 10 more to go, and I don't want to indulge in cliches, but I do think that you of this generation facing me, the old man of the sea, because I'll be 61 years old this year. Have respect for your elders, by the way. That you are facing probably the greatest opportunity and the greatest challenge of any generation of American young people have ever faced. Matthew Arnold, the English essayist, wrote some time ago that we stand between two worlds. One world is dead, and the other world has not yet been born. He wrote that about 30, 35 years ago. And I believe that what he wrote then has now come to pass. That you now stand upon the threshold of a new world. Whether it will be a better world or not, I do not know. I have faith in you that you will make it a better world. Because after all of my years of experience, 39 years in public life, and a quarter of a century in the Congress, I do not think anyone can make this world much worse than it is now. I would like to talk with you around three focal points. One, I'd like to talk to you about black power. The next, I would like to talk to you about the new administration. May God help us. And third, I would like to talk to you about your place in this world. Let us talk about black power. There have been so many people who have been defining it according to their own definition. I would like to therefore give you the background of my own life so that what I do say when I finish, you at least say, well, he went through certain phases of black power, and he should know a little bit about what black power means. Black power was first created in the thinking of a black man from Jamaica, British West Indies, who came to New York City when I was about 50 years ago, when I was 11 years old. His name was Marcus Garvey. I was the first one to create the phrase black power. As the years came, and as the years went, we began to picket on the streets of America. I have here in the audience tonight, I don't know where he is, Snow Grigsby from Detroit. He's one of the early picketers back with me. He picketed in Detroit. I picketed in Harlem. All over America, we walked the streets as my beloved friend Martin said in my pulpit a year ago, January, before some of us were born, before some of us could talk, before some of us could walk, there was a group in this nation, and in Harlem it was Adam Powell, leading in nonviolent protest, black power, to strike down the walls of white power Jericho, that black people might have equality. When I first went to Congress 24 years ago, I wrote a book, which was a bestseller, called Marching Blacks, in which I defined the concept of black power. I convened the first black power conference in the United States in the offices of the Committee on Education and Labor 4 years ago. That was the first annual black power conference. Now we have Ron Karenga, Nathan Wright, Cleaver, Stokely, Rapp, Floyd McKissick, many others giving their versions of black power. With all due deference to them and respect for them, they're all my friends, I would like to tell you what black power means. In the first place, black power is not anti-white. Now drive that into your skull and remember it. It's not anti-white except insofar as white people make us dislike whites. In other words, we do not go out openly with a chip on our shoulders, but we do go out saying, let the chips fall where they may. That's the first step, black power. Black power is not racism anymore than Jews who belong to B'nai B'rith, or Poles who belong to the Polish American Congress, or Irish who belong to the Sons of St. Patrick, or Italians who belong to the Federation of Italian American Organizations. Black power is merely a coming of age of black people and saying to the other ethnic groups of America, we demand, and we will take no less, that you respect us as your equal, and we're going to fight with every God-given means to make you believe that we are your equal. That's Black Power. It means to cultivate black dignity. It means to cultivate black integrity. It means to know that black is beautiful, baby. Black is beautiful. My father used to say, I don't know why white men are so worried about black men looking after their chicks, because in our race, we got everything from chalk to charcoal. And it's beautiful. And it's beautiful. As the Black Panthers have stated, and they meet, the Harlem group meets in my church, we are not aggressors, but we are defenders. We do not believe in total nonviolence. Now, this is where you've got to think with me. We do not believe in violence per se, but not in total nonviolence. We are not going to stand idly by and see any of our loved ones or even strangers. And sometimes those strangers might be you with white faces getting whipped and beaten without doing something to help the cause. I think one of the greatest things that happened to white America was what Mayor Daley did in Chicago. I think it's one of the greatest things. It let white America know, your mothers and fathers, your priests and preachers, as they sat in the comfort of their suburban recreation rooms and watched it on TV, that white young people could be beaten the same as black young people if they dared to defy the establishment of a guy like Daley. As regards this question of violence and nonviolence, may I read a May 1967 an article by Martin. Just before I read this, Martin came to Bimini several times. Last time he came, just before he was assassinated, he said that he had come to the opinion, Andy Young was there, Abernathy was there, sat and we kicked it around for 2 or 3 hours, he had come to the opinion that total nonviolence was no longer the answer. And I said, Martin, you forgot that a year and a half ago you wrote, and I read what he wrote. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men in the ghettos, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they continue to ask me, what about Vietnam? They asked me, if our nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, and their questions hit home. And I knew then that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. I was Martin Luther King in May of 1967. So we do not believe in violence, but we do not believe in total nonviolence. When you say our young people turn out in the streets, in riots, in burnings, in looting, you must realize the frustration and the bitterness that is welling up in their hearts. They're tired of seeing that black mother come home late at night getting paid less for the same job that a white woman get paid for. They're tired of seeing their fathers, because they're over 40, the permanent unemployables of America, sitting there, not able to get a job. They're tired of their brothers and sisters being pushed out of schools, not dropouts, pushouts. Schools like New York City, where in the ghettos of New York City, black boys and girls, when they finish fourth grade publication, when they finish fourth grade education with the same teachers, same textbooks, same money per capita, they are 72% behind their white brother and white sister going to the same public school system in New York City. They're tired of that. Therefore, they strike out blindly. And that's why a lot of us believe that the only solution to our educational problem is decentralization of the schools. We want our schools run by the people who are interested in the poor black and the poor white child and the poor Puerto Rican in our areas. And regardless of any argument you may give me, I say turn to Time Magazine's article on John Lindsay a few months ago and read what Time says, that McCoy, in the Oceanville section where all of the disturbance has taken place, has produced, according to Time Magazine, the best school district in New York City, black or white. We know we can do it. We know we can do it. Black power also means that we demand, since most of our institutions of learning are accepting funds from the federal government, we demand, short of a citizen's taxpayer suit, that every campus in America that gets one penny of federal funds shall have on its faculties qualified black men, qualified black women as full professors to teach the truth about the black man's contributions to American life. We demand this. Don't listen to an old racial has-been like Roy Wilkins coming on TV the other night and saying that Afro-American students were wrong and that he was going to use the money of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People to fight Afro-American students who are demanding these things. The very time that he was delivering that diatribe on TV, 200 white students at Brandeis University struck with 85 blacks for better Afro-American conditions at Brandeis University. In other words, there is not only a black militant, there's a white militant as well. There's a new black man, a new white man, and by the grace of God, blood, sweat, or tears are alive, we're going to build a new society. I just clipped this the other day from Princeton University's report to show you how tragic the gap is between your parents, your preachers, your priests, your politicians, and your presidents. The most prestigious testing group in the United States is the Educational Testing Service of Princeton. They have just released the result of an 8-page questionnaire they sent to 5,000 trustees before the revolution at Columbia University, if you please, before that. In the first place, they found out that the typical college trustee is white, Protestant, in his 50s, Republican, and makes more than $30,000 a year. That's the typical trustee. Now, on the basis of this report, listen to this now. 5,000 trustees of colleges and universities say that faculty power should be limited to academic affairs, such as adding courses or setting admission policies. 50% of the trustees said the faculty should not even have power to appoint a dean or decide about faculty leave. 53% said the faculty should sign loyalty oaths. Loyal to what? To them, of course. 40% said the trustees want less voice on the campus for the students. 40% said they would not allow students to share decisions about student housing. 22% said the students should not have a voice in selecting speakers. 40% said the administration should control the copy in the student newspapers. And then says Rodney Hartnett, the psychologist who wrote the study, and I quote from him, "We might as well expect greater conflict and disruption of the academic program this year unless this establishment changes its views." And he's right. He's right. Don't underestimate your power. Look what happened to the Chancellor of the University of California. Look what happened to the Chancellor of Columbia University. And there, black and whites together said, "We're going to change this situation." And together, even though they got their heads whipped and went to prison, together they did change the situation. The only thing we haven't been able to change was our national administration. That's why when I went across the country, I praised Wallace so much. Not because I agreed with him, but at least he had the guts to say what he believed. He did. We are a leaderless society. We not only have our topless waitresses, but we got our topless leaders. I don't know what's going to happen to us. A group of people were talking to me the other day and said, "There are no national black leaders left." I said, "There are no national white leaders left either." We've come to a moment of history totally unprepared. We had a choice in the campaign between Tweedledum and Tweedledee. And I think Dumb won. I don't say this is a Democrat because I left the Democratic Party and supported Eisenhower years ago. I'm a political maverick. But it so happens that Mr. Nixon and also Jack Kennedy were members of my committee in the House, Committee of Education and Labor. Can you imagine a man assuming the leadership of this nation in this particularly trying era that we are passing through? When the whole world is looking to the United States for a leadership that we do not have, and then picking a cabinet without a single black person or a single Jew in the cabinet even. LBJ didn't. Kennedy didn't. He has a completely WASP cabinet. Sometimes I think Danny Moynihan isn't a Catholic. I think he's a WASP. They asked me the other day, "What about the fact that Nick Rose did not support Nixon. One's as bad as the other. Why should he give him a position in the cabinet? I said, on that basis, he shouldn't cooperate with the Democratic Party, which is the largest party in the United States, because they fought him. We are in for a period that you have not seen in your lifetime. You have been through the period of Kennedy and LBJ, but you're not going to go through that period now. You're going through a period where a man who's leader of this nation has already announced that he is going to tackle inflation by bringing about chronic unemployment." That's Nixon's statement. In other words, the unemployables, the minorities, are going to be kicked out of jobs so that there will not be any inflation to help those on the top floor. You're going to see a man who is going to take the war on poverty bill and chop it up and send it right back where it came from, agriculture, HEW, labor, and other agencies. You're going to see a man turn back the whole progress of the United States. He's going to be something like the couplet that Samuel Huffenstein once wrote in his book, Poems in Praise of Practically Nothing. "Come weal, come woe, my status is quo." I shudder to think of an administration where the Attorney General has not even been sworn in and has already announced that he is going to utilize the wiretapping laws. Already announced it. Probably wiretapping us right now. Incidentally, I don't want to say this because I might lose half the audience, but all those of you on the payroll of CIA and FBI can leave now if you want to. Now, this is going to be a very dismal, bleak scene, this administration. I think the only chance we had was when I proposed that Wallace and I run together on an integrated ticket. The only thing is, Wallace wanted to run for president, and I wanted to run for president. And then I said, well, maybe we could stage a parade. So I said, I'll run for vice president. Maybe we could stage a parade if he ran for president and got elected. Now, if I was president of the United States, the first thing I'd do, I'd paint the White House half black. And I'd make Rap Brown Secretary of Defense. Cleaver would be head of the Bureau of Prisons. Stokely Carmichael would be the head of the Department of State, and Eartha Kitt, chief of protocol. Now, let's get down to the business about what you can do and what you must do. Lord Tennyson, Le Mort d'Arthur, wrote, "The old order changeth, giving way to the new." You have this power in your hands. I started propounding this doctrine back in January a year ago when I spoke at Berkeley, California. January 14th, when I had 12,500 in the plaza there in front of Sproul Hall. So we're saying to you, come on, take our hand. What's wrong with trusting black leadership? We founded this country by giving the first martyr, Crispus Attucks. He died on Boston Commons. We have emblazed along the streets of America with over 6,000 pieces of strange fruit, the pathway of making America a country that finally gave up lynching. We have showed through our young men that we don't care anymore. We've shown through some of our older men that we're willing to go the last mile. I know it's kind of hard for you young white people who come from out of the snug and smug wombs of our prison society to realize that this is a time when you can follow other people. Your group has had its day. The world is not judging the United States anymore by that stately building in Foggy Bottom on the cool banks of the Potomac River, the Department of State. But the world today is judging the United States of America by what it is doing to black men and black women in the United States. Mark my word, I'm telling the truth. I have had them from Denmark all the way down into Zambia and Ghana and all through South America and Central America say to me, how can you expect us, Mr. Powell, to follow this leadership that you profess when we know that you're not practicing at home with your own people? Stuart Alsop wrote the other day that America has already become a second-class power. And I believe that the only people that are going to save this country are going to be people like you who will have the strength of character and the breadth of wisdom and the willingness to throw aside the ancient shibboleths that have been taught to you by your parents and by your priests and preachers and politicians and say, as Walt Whitman, come take my hand. Let us stay with each other as long as we live. The world is depending upon this, and we can do it. I stand as an old man in front of you and look back through the years and can tell you we can do it. If we will learn to stand together, walk together, work together, picket together, vote together, then and only then we can win together, black and white. That's the only way. There was a tall, gaunt man that walked at midnight on Pennsylvania Avenue, and he said that the only government that would never perish from the earth would be a government of the people, black and white, for the people, Jew and Gentile, and by the people, Protestant and Catholic. And that's the government we need to search for. Don't put it off. You look out and say, who can our leaders be? For some strange reason, I don't know why, I've known him for years, Gene McCarthy has left us. His attitudes and his actions are so bizarre. He cannot be the same man that I have known all my life in Capitol Hill. So all is not hopeless. If we can get a meeting of the minds between Ted Kennedy and Julian Bond this year and start, if necessary, a third party in this nation, finish with all of the cobwebs of the Democrat and Republican Party. Julian Bond almost stampeded that Democratic convention. I had my people on the floor counting votes. If he hadn't said, I will not take the office, he might have been the vice presidential nominee. Julian Bond is a comer. Ted Kennedy has arrived. And I want you, therefore, to throw your arms around these two men and others that might come up. And let's go on now and build a new party if necessary. If we can't capture the old, then build a new one. A national party to save the republic for black and for white and for every mother's son of God. That's what we need. And I wish I had the voice of a clarion and fingers of fire. I wish I could write these words across the sable breasts of darkness and cry them into the blackness of midnight. Let's stand together and work together and love together. And by the grace of a God who rules above with a hand of power and a heart of love, I know we'll win together. One from here, one from here, one from there, and one from the center. All right. All right, who'll be first in this balcony to ask a question? I'll do my... Let's figure it out now. I got a Baptist voice, but not a Baptist ear.
I have just finished
one practical answer, and that is to get in touch with Bertha Klausner, K-L-A-U-S-N-E-R, and say that I said so. She's the number one literary book agent in New York City. Up there. Over in this section, anybody?
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Well, I would say the question was, Ted supported Humphrey. Why should we embrace Ted? Your question is very good. There's no getting around it. But, all right, this section over here, the question? This section over here? Yes, sir. Right. In the first place, I didn't want to raise this issue because I know that it's a touchy one, but I believe that the first place, we got to get out of Vietnam and get out now. We've got to get out of Vietnam because it's a senseless war. It's a war, and I ask you a question. If we win it, what have we won? It's a war that is draining $32 billion out of our pocketbooks each year, which should go into programs to train people to work in this automated age. It's a war that if we do win Vietnam, then they will start bleeding us in Laos and Cambodia and Thailand. So I say get out. It doesn't mean that we're going to be isolationists. It means that we get out and we give it to the United Nations. We cannot be the cops of the world. By what mandate of God have we got the right to be the cops of the world, to force upon the world a type of democracy which we won't practice here at home? So if we can get this $32 billion back into the financial bloodstream of our domestic policies, all of these buildings, for instance, on this campus that are 7 years of age or younger, were built by the Higher Education Facilities Act, which was passed under my chairmanship. Many of you in this audience are receiving scholarships which came from my committee. Those have all been whittled down. The monies for next year will not be there unless we get out of Vietnam and start making the Manpower Development Training Act work. That's the act which will take the unemployables over 40 and teach them skills for this new day. It'll take the push-outs in Operation Head Start and teach them a skill. You can take a high school graduate today and send him to an IBM school, and in 8 to 12 months, he'll be drawing down a salary between $8,000 and $15,000 a year as a high school graduate. X-ray technicians are being paid today $7,000 to $12,000 a year, high school graduates. These are places that we haven't tapped yet in our American economy. And all you've got to do is go to places like California and see the Sunday Los Angeles Times and see full page ads where they're begging for people to work here and work there in not quite highly skilled jobs, but skilled enough that the Manpower Development Training Act could not train them for, which I envisioned when I first put it through. This was the first piece of legislation I put through 8 years ago. All right, someone else. Yes, sir, one. First one there. What's that? I don't know. Who does, for instance, you see? I know, for one, that if I could see someone with the vision and the courage and the youth of a Teddy and a Julian, that I would leave the Democratic Party to follow him. I would. It's my personal commitment. Oh, yeah. One. All right. Yes, lady.
What about family allowances? What do you think
of that? About what? Oh, family allowances. Well, that's a state matter, isn't it? The state welfare system? Yeah. I do believe, however, in a guaranteed minimum wage, guaranteed annual wage, I believe in that.
What about a national family allowance?
I believe in anything that will make the people of Detroit, Michigan receive from the government as little amount as the people are receiving now in Mississippi. In other words, you bring them up so we have at least a national level of poverty instead of a dual standard. Last one. Well, the Supreme Court on Monday, ordered the judges, the lawyers on both sides to be ready for oral argument and dismissed the motion of Bromley, the lawyer for Congress, that the case should be dismissed because I was seated, and he said the question is now moot. The Supreme Court told Bromley it's not moot. We are judging the 90th Congress, and he was seated in the 91st. Get your argument together, and we go. You come before us on February 13th. Okay, one last one, okay. In the Middle East, I believe there again. There again, it's a matter that should be given to the United Nations. To give the United Nations. I make no brief for either side. I make no brief for the Arab guerrilla bands who came over and killed civilians in the marketplace. And I make no brief for the Israeli forces that went over and destroyed those planes. And one reason why everybody got so excited about the planes being destroyed was because most of the stock in those airlines are owned by American people and the United States.